for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Edward Albee has been writing plays for over a half a century. Among his more revered work, A Delicate Balance, The Zoo Story, Three Tall Women, and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Over the years, Albee has received numerous awards, and the honors keep coming. A new festival at Washington, D.C.'s Arena Stage brings the most unparalleled presentations of his work. It includes nearly every one of his plays staged over a two-month period. Joining us in the studio, renowned playwright Edward Albee and Molly Smith, the artistic director of Arena Stage. Edward Albee has said that a playwright's job is to ask interesting questions and expect the audience to provide the answers, some good answers, and we're expecting the same from both of you this morning.
We'll try.
Good morning to you. It's so good to have
good
you
morning.
Here.
Good morning.
Good morning,
Diane.
And you are welcome to join us with your questions and comments. 800-433-8850. You can all wish Mr. Albee a happy birthday. He turned 83 on Saturday and looks hale and hearty. How's it feel?
Better than not turning 83.
I agree with you. You know, your first play was published when you were just 30. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, I was 28 when I wrote it.
28 when you wrote
it. I started writing poetry when I was 7, and I quit that when I was 22 because I was getting better, but I wasn't all that good. Huh. And I wrote two terrible novels in my teens, really, really bad. Maybe no American teenager could have written two worse novels than I did. And the short story and I didn't get along terribly well, but I decided that I was a writer. Having failed as a composer, I'd listened to Bach, and I thought, hey, if anybody can do that, I want to do that.
Sure.
But I wasn't as good as Bach, so I didn't do that. And I hit my middle 20s, and I said, well, I'm a writer. What am I doing? Why don't I write a play? So I wrote one called The Zoo Story, and I realized something. Edward, this is the best thing you've ever written. Maybe you're a playwright. And that turned out to work out better.
So when you first took it to someone, whom did you take it to?
Well, I took it to a number of well-known American playwrights who said nice things but didn't do anything to help. But I knew a lot of young American composers. And one of them arranged for a translation into German. So my play, The Zoo Story, had its world premiere in German, in Berlin.
Oh, my gosh.
On a double bill with Beckett's Krapp's Last Tape.
Wow.
September 28th, 1956, I guess it was. And I had to go to Berlin for that, of course. You can only see the world premiere of your first play when it happens. So I went to Berlin and sat there. This American, young American playwright sat there watching the world premiere of his first play in a language he didn't speak.
And you just sat there and watched and listened.
And I spent a lot of my time looking at the audience to see how they were responding.
Oh, sure.
Which proved to me that I was a playwright. And it worked out fine.
And in 1960, it was put on off Broadway.
A year later, in 59, it opened in New York, in English this time, on the same double bill with the Beckett play. And we ran for 3 years.
Wow.
And so I decided, hey, you're a playwright.
Molly, what was your first encounter with Edward Albee?
My first encounter with Edward Albee was through his work, which I think is the best way to encounter any artist. And when I was a young person studying in the theater, I read The Zoo Story, and it took the back of my head off. So that's why it's so fantastic to have him here with us at Arena Stage, because his work has influenced so many of us in the theater, whether we're writers, whether actors, directors, designers, because his work is so provocative.
What do you think is the most distinct element of Edward Albee's work? I'm going to ask you, and then I'm going to ask him.
For me, it's his ability to go to the darkest, deepest parts of the human psyche and take us into those dangerous places and let us know it's safe to be there. Here's a way out.
Give me an example.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a perfect example of where the story goes in terms of their relationship, because ultimately it's a relationship about love.
Let's hear a tiny excerpt of that play.
What are you doing now, Martha?
I'm telling a story. Sit down, you'll learn something.
All righty.
You come back.
That's right.
Theory's come back.
Yes, I see.
Where was I?
I'm so glad.
Shh.
Oh, yeah, along came George. That's right. Who was young, intelligent, and bushy-tailed, and sort of cute, if you can imagine it.
And younger than you.
And younger than me.
By 6 years.
By 6 years. It doesn't bother me, George. And along he came, bright-eyed, into the history department. And do you know what I did, dumb cluck that I am? You know what I did? I fell for him.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, she did. You should have seen it. She'd sit outside of my room on the lawn at night, and she'd howl and claw at the turf. I couldn't work.
I actually fell for him. It. That. There.
Martha's a romantic at heart.
That I am. So, I actually fell for him, and the match seemed practical, too. You know, Daddy was looking for someone to take over sometime when he was ready to retire.
Just a minute, Martha.
And so I thought that...
Stop it, Martha.
What do you want?
I thought you were telling the story of our courtship, Martha. I didn't know you were going to start in on the other business.
Well, I am.
I wouldn't if I were you.
Oh, you wouldn't? Well, you're not.
Now, you've already sprung a leak about you know what.
What? What?
About the apple of our eye, the sprout, the little bugger, our son. And if you start in on this other business, I warn you, Martha, it's going to make me angry.
Oh, it is it?
I warn you.
You what?
I warn you.
Do you really think we have to go through...
I stand warned.
Wow.
I wonder what recording that is. I wonder what performance that is. I didn't recognize the voices.
I think it's Tracy. I think it's Tracy Letts and Amy Morton.
No, I don't think so. Really?
I think so.
Oh, well, okay.
Well, do you agree with Molly that is the kind of work you intend to do and succeed in doing, taking us to the deepest parts and displaying?
Well, I can't talk objectively about my own work, but I think the people who go to the theater, and considering the prices of theater, especially in New York, and spend $120, and they go to the theater and they want nothing to happen to them. They don't want to be upset. They don't want to be educated. They don't want to be informed of anything. They just want to go and waste their time. I don't understand what kind of theater that is. And I like to be provocative, I suppose. I like to shake people up a little bit. You know, if you're going to spend all that money, something should happen to you.
Absolutely. And you heard Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award winner Tracy Letts as George, Tony Award nominee Amy Morton as Martha. It also stars Carrie Coon as Honey and Madison Dirks as Dick. That was a powerful excerpt, I must say. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Edward Albee, for you, having this retrospective, what's it like to see all of those plays?
Well, I'm very grateful that the Arena Stage has been doing either performances or stage readings of almost all of my work, and is for the next few weeks. It's a little puzzling. My God, did he do all that? And why isn't there more? And no, it's very exciting and gratifying for it to happen. Because usually the only stuff that gets done is your latest commercial success. Mm-mm. And people just ignore the stuff that was really good that you've written before that was critically unpopular, but it's probably better than a lot of the really popular stuff.
Really?
And so this way, people get to see the whole thing and judge you not on your most recent commercial success, but on what you've been up to for the past 50 years. That's
but
nice.
How do you judge yourself?
How did I what?
How do you judge yourself?
I keep hoping I'm getting better. I think I'm a pretty interesting playwright. I don't think I waste people's time because I don't think art should go around being decorative and wasting your time. I think maybe I can upset a few people and maybe change the nature of theater a little bit.
Do you ever go back and think, I wish I had written it this way instead of this way?
Yeah, but I don't go around and revise something that I've done 20 years ago.
You don't?
Because I'm not the same person. I don't let anybody else rewrite my texts. Why should I let me do it 20 years after I've written the play?
Edward Albee, his Edward Albee Festival is at the Arena Stage here in Washington. He's an American playwright who's best known for The Zoo Story, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, A Delicate Balance, and many more. Molly Smith, Artistic Director of Arena Stage. Short break, right back. And I understand that today is Molly Smith's birthday. So the two of you coming here on this day, we're just delighted to wish you both.
Happy birthday, Molly.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Edward.
I like it.
I can't think of any place I'd rather be than with you on my birthday.
Oh, she's sweet.
How lovely. Tell me about Three Tall Women, which is said to be one of your most personal plays.
It may be most personal because it is about I was an orphan, and I was adopted into a wealthy theatrical management family. We never got along particularly well. They gave me a great education in private schools, and I'm eternally grateful that I ended up being educated in a way that helped me, you know, become a three-dimensional human being. But we didn't get along particularly well. And
how old were you when you were adopted?
2 weeks old.
2 weeks old.
I had nothing to say about it.
I see. Quite right. Who were they?
The Keith Albee Vaudeville Circuit back in the old days ran 350 vaudeville theaters around the United States and hired all of the vaudeville performers. Gave them 50-week contracts. It was a very, very good organization. And they had theaters all over the United States. And a man named Jill Kennedy bought it all out about 1927. And so the whole family retired and just sat around being rich.
Whoa. And your father left?
Well, the adoptive father, he retired. And, well, they were perfectly nice people. They kept saddle horses and, you know, the WASP rich life. And there was all of that. And I never felt that I belonged there.
What does that mean?
Well, I felt that this... I had an intuitive sense that this environment wasn't mine.
Did you know you were adopted?
I knew I was adopted.
You knew that.
In the days when I was adopted, you weren't allowed to ever know who your natural parents were. So I've never been able to find out where I came from. You know, I'm sort of interested to know where I got my bizarre mind from, but I'll never find out. Anyway, after my adoptive mother died, we'd made up. We left rather unpleasantly with each other, but we made up, and she got ill, and I was a dutiful son. And I decided to write a play about her after she died. Didn't want to do it before she died, and I didn't want her to have any say in what I wrote about her. And it was called Three Tall Women. And it was about her life and the way she lived it and the way she reacted to growing old and ill. And it wasn't a revenge play. Some people said, as a matter of fact, who knew her well, said I was too nice about her afterwards. But it was a play about this woman, split into three parts, herself as young, herself as middle-aged, and herself as old, played by three separate performers.
What was she like in real life?
In my life, she was a dominating, insisting that everything she valued was the way everything should be, and didn't want to brook any interference. It made communication a little difficult sometimes.
Was she loving?
I don't think she knew quite how to be. I think that was it.
She and your father wanted a child.
The patriarch of the family, old E.F. Holby, decided he wanted a grandson, so I turned up.
But you never felt as though you quite fit.
No, I didn't.
So you took to writing.
If I'd felt that I belonged, I would have turned out like them.
Exactly. You wouldn't have been a writer.
Yeah, of course not. Never.
Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Did you know all of this about Edward Albee Molly?
I believe I know most of it. And what's really fascinating to me is how one becomes a writer. How... you know, if this was a spur to be a writer.
But there's the basic question about how one becomes who one will become.
Mm-hmm. How one becomes who one is, really.
Exactly.
Yes.
And you found the way. You left at 20. You moved to Greenwich Village. What did you do there?
I had odd jobs for about 8 years. I educated myself in all of the arts because in those days, in the late 40s and early 50s, Greenwich Village was the hotbed and the center of all of the experimental arts, of painting, of music, of writing, of theater. It was the headquarters of all of the avant-garde arts in the United States. So I just continued my having gotten thrown out of college in my sophomore year, I just went back to college and it was called the Arts in Greenwich Village. It was wonderful.
So you became a self-educated man.
Basically, I continued. Basically.
Which college did you go to?
I went to Trinity College in Hartford for a year and a half. I got thrown out because they ran the joint and they wanted me to take certain courses that I didn't think I needed. And they wouldn't let me take the ones I wanted to take. They were right.
They were right.
Yeah.
But you were right as well that you needed the experiential learning.
Yeah, the education is supposed to be to educate the individual, not according to some plan.
You are gay, mm-hmm. And you have made...
Hate the term, but yes.
I know it
sounds so frivolous.
You've made a distinction between being a gay writer and a writer who is gay.
Yes.
What's the difference?
I felt no need, because I happen to be gay, I feel no need to write only about gay people and gay subjects, because we are such a small portion of civilization. We've done accomplished a lot. Many of the creative people in the world, more than the you would imagine, are and have been gay. But I don't believe in any kind of parochialism. And so I write about whoever I need to write about. And I don't know, do I write about things from the point of view of a gay person? I'm not sure that I do. I think being gay gives me access to both sexes in a way that somebody else might not have.
I'm thinking about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and wondering where the depiction of those characters came from.
Probably a little bit from my own childhood environment, a little bit from people I observed. And also, if you're a writer, you invent stuff. That's what you're supposed to do. You invent people who should be realer than real people.
But you've seen that kind of behavior.
Hmm?
You've seen that kind of behavior.
Oh, yeah, sure. But also, I take that as a jumping-off place to invent real people who behave in a similar fashion.
You know, Molly Smith, the phrase brutally honest comes up again and again in terms of Edward Albee's writing. What does that phrase mean to you?
Brutally honest means to me a fearlessness of going into who we actually are as opposed to who we would like to be or who we pretend we are. And I think that that's one of Edward's greatest gifts, is the ability to be brutally honest and show us ourselves in the middle of the theater. I mean, it really is about the theater as a community event, the theater as a place where we grapple with the greatest and deepest parts of ourselves. And I think he does that again and again, whether it's in The Goat or Who is Sylvie, whether it is in The Zoo Story, whether it is in A Delicate Balance, Me, Myself, and I. He consistently takes us to places that we may not want to go, and yet when we're there, our own ideas about ourselves becomes exposed.
That's my job.
That's your job, and that's your gift. One of those plays may mean a great deal to you. Which would you say it is?
Of the 30? I'm not unhappy that I wrote any of them. I think they're all relatively useful. In other words, that they hold a mirror up to us and say, look, this is who you are. If you don't like what you see, don't ignore what you see. Change. You know, if you think that things would be better if you were different, then learn. Learn. All plays, if they're any, all art, if it's any good, teaches us more about who we are and how we respond to our environment and our culture.
How do those plays affect you internally after you finished writing Virginia Woolf, for example?
Well, after I finished writing a play, I look at it and I say, really, was that what was going on in your mind?
Huh.
Wow. Hey, maybe this will be helpful. Maybe this will be useful, because I think all art should be useful. Merely decorative is not enough. Not safe and decorative. Is this useful? Can anybody learn anything from this? And is it skillfully enough done so that people won't realize that they're learning anything?
When I write, I learn about myself from what I've written. Do you?
You know, it's nice to be able to spend your life doing one of the few things you can do with any competence, and enjoy doing it.
Mm.
I really love being a writer. I love writing.
And you learn about yourself as you write.
Yes, but sometimes I learn some things that I'm not terribly happy with.
Like?
But I go right on.
Like?
Oh, you know, the tendency to want to slow down, the tendency to lie to yourself, the tendency to be not as really on target as you might be, that the desire to be accepted and therefore being safe. You have to resist all of those temptations.
Edward Albee, his plays are being featured at the Edward Albee Festival at Arena Stage in Washington. Molly Smith is the artistic director of Arena Stage, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers who'd like to speak with you, so let's open the phones. 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Good morning, Joe. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. I just wanted to say to Mr. Albee, I think he's one of the greatest American dramatists ever and very much inspired me to write when I was very young. And thank you for the many years of great work.
You're more than welcome.
You have really championed writers. You've tried to help young writers, and clearly that's one you've inspired.
Well, if you don't do that, you're just being selfish. It's your responsibility as a writer to help younger writers have the opportunity to practice their craft, maybe even more easily than you were able to.
How do you help them?
I teach at a university. I've been teaching for 20 years at the University of Houston. I teach young playwrights. I go around and I lecture at colleges to young writers. I talk about the arts and the importance of the arts in our culture and our society, and bemoan the fact that we don't teach the arts in our schools anywhere nearly as much as we should.
You must be just beside yourself hearing about the lack of education to the arts, how it's being dismissed, diminished throughout the school
well,
system.
Well, you know, if we don't educate kids in the arts and only in how to make money and how to succeed in business, we're going to have a society of highly educated barbarians.
Maybe we are on the road.
Sometimes I fear we are.
Let's go to Arcadia, Florida. Good morning, Carla.
Good morning. I had the privilege of hearing Edward Albee lecture in Naples a few years ago, and I really enjoyed it, of course. And I think that his plays are, for me, they're boundary breaking. And I just wondered if he would consider writing a play to end the culture of celebrity in America. And that would be doing a great public service. And also, if he could comment about his friendship with Louise Nevelson.
Well, let me tell you about. I was at a reading of one of my plays at the Arena Stage yesterday afternoon. A play called "The Man Who Had Three Arms," which is a play about celebrity in the United States, a man who becomes the most famous person in the world because he has grown a third arm out of the center of his back. And it's an examination of the falsity of most celebrity in the United States. So I wrote that one, and that was despised by the critics because it was in part about them. And so it's very, very seldom performed, which was too bad. I did write a play about my dear friend Louise Nevelson, A, because I thought she was a first-rate sculptor, and also because she was one of the most fascinating, boundary-breaking women I've ever known in my life.
Boundary-breaking in what sense?
Well, because if you were a female artist in the United States, especially back in the 30s and the 40s when she was starting out, you weren't welcome in the art world. Women really weren't welcomed, and they had to fight. Women still have it tough in painting and sculpture. their work doesn't sell for more than half of what the male artist does. They're not given the same kind of museum shows.
Why do you think that is?
Because women are supposed to stay home and have babies.
You think that's still the overriding sentiment?
Unfortunately, yes.
Unfortunately is right. Molly, would you agree?
Well, I would say that during my lifetime, I'm 59 today, but I've watched women keep rising up, up, up. But I would say that women still have not risen as far as we need to. I still think that there are more glass ceilings to break, but fortunately, we have a lot of little stiletto heels.
Molly Smith is the artistic director of Arena Stage here in Washington, which is performing the Edward Albee Festival. And short break, we'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at metlife.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
Frank Calabrese Jr. has written a new memoir about bringing down his father's murderous Chicago crime family. While both were in prison for racketeering, Frank wore a wire against his father.
I was wired up like a Christmas tree, and I'm standing in an area with a lot of Italian guys, a lot of outfit guys, a lot of everybody. If that wire is spotted, I don't think I'm making it back.
Join us.
If you've just joined us, playwright Edward Albee is here with Molly Smith. She's the artistic director of Arena Stage here in Washington, which is putting on an Edward Albee Festival between now and April 24th, where his plays are being presented in full. Some are being read by actors, but it's totally complete enjoyment. Do join us. We'll go back to the phones to Boston, Massachusetts. Good morning, Michael. You're on the air.
Yes, Mr. Albee.
Albee.
I wanted to ask you a question about Virginia Woolf.
Sure.
And the book in the play, and seems to me a form of impotence. Or, I mean, it's pretty obvious, I guess, that it's impotence. But the impotence.
Define impotence.
Well, it's the child that they refer to that they never have is paralleled by the book that's never written by George. So I wondered if I were right about that, if the impotence that you might be referring to is something to do with more about cultural and artistic impotence in the United States, or is it something else, or am I completely off base?
No, I sure hope you're right. Yes. Now, the reason that they had to invent a child was because they physically could not have one. That is not impotence. That is something else. Yes, the cultural impotence, of course.
Thanks for calling, Michael. And by the way, Mr. Olby's name is pronounced as though there are two L's when there is, in fact, only one. It's Edward Olby. I hope that settles it.
Thank you, dear.
Let's go to Jonesboro, Arkansas. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning. This has been such a treat to get to sort of hear some of the behind-the-scenes stuff for what's going on. And I had a question about the goat, or who is Sylvia. It's such a fantastically complicated show, and I teach theater on the university level, and I find that a lot of times my students seem to be very single-minded about it, and they think it's very, they take it very literally and think that it's literally just about the idea of bestiality, and they are always delightfully surprised when we talk about it, you know, sort of extending a little bit more. And I was wondering if that had been your experience in terms of the reception of that play.
No two people see the same play. Mm. And this play, The Goat or Who is Sylvia, I've always had people walk out of.
Really?
Always. Every performance, somebody's walking out of it because...
Why do you think that is?
Because some people are deeply offended to think that a person could fall in love with another animal. And the play is not about bestiality. The fact is about the nature of love and should there be any limitations on it, basically.
Does that answer it, Lisa?
It does. It does. And I think if people are walking out of your shows, it probably means you're doing something right.
I think I am. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Let's go now to Austin, Texas, where John has a question about Tiny Alice. Go right ahead, John.
Thank you. Yes, I've been a fan of Mr. Albee for many years and have been especially fascinated by his play Tiny Alice. And I recall at the time it was quite controversial and met with pretty much universal incomprehension, and even the principal actors.
That's all called theater criticism.
Yeah, pretty standard. But John Gielgud, who was the star of the show, said in his memoir that he didn't understand it at all.
Well, John said that about every play he was in.
I guess my question to you, sir, is, do you think that performers need to understand what they're doing on the stage in order to be effective?
They don't need to understand the implications or the metaphors of what they're doing, but they do have to understand the characters that they're playing. And John penetrated deeply into every character that he's ever played, and I've seen him on stage a lot. I saw him on stage a lot. And he gave me the impression when he was playing Brother Julian in Tiny Alice, he gave me the impression that he was that person, that he was that character.
There is no greater achievement, truly. All right. To Walter, who's here in Washington, D.C. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes. Mr. Albee, I wanted to know a little bit more about your experiences at Trinity College. My wife and I are members of the class of 74, and in fact, that was the very first class that went co-ed. And I was told by several upperclassmen that there were several features of life on campus that were abruptly abolished because women were now members of the student body. So, for example, one question I have for you, were you ever forced to wear a beanie during your freshman year?
No, I missed the beanie. I was young enough and foolish enough that I considered becoming a fraternity member.
Uh-huh.
But then I discovered that the fraternity that I thought I might join had a number of limitations as to their membership. They did not permit blacks, they did not permit Jews, and they did not permit gays.
Wow.
And so I decided not to become a fraternity member.
Well, that's interesting. You see, I'm of African-American heritage, and I was a subject of the affirmative action program that was at Trinity, since Trinity was an active supporter of this program.
Yes, good for you.
So I mean, Trinity was one of the greatest experiences of my life, and I now work at the Library of Congress with my wife, but we always remembered that you were the most famous dropout from Trinity.
You know what was funny about that? Yeah, they threw me out in the middle of my sophomore year. Then 15 years later, after I'd begun to make something of a reputation for myself, they wrote me a nice letter saying they wanted to give me an honorary degree.
How about that? Did you go to...
No, I turned them down. I said, you were right to throw me out. But 10 years later, they sent me another letter saying, please. And I said, all right.
And you did.
And I took it, yeah.
Congratulations. Let me ask you about the film production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? I gather you had other people in mind for those roles.
When Warner Brothers said they wanted to make a film of my play, I was sort of interested in who they planned to put in it. So I went out to Los Angeles and had a meeting with Jack Warner, who ran Warner Brothers, and I said, who are you putting in it? Because this will determine whether I let you have it. And he said, I'm buying it for Bette Davis and James Mason. And I said, wow, that's a wonderful idea. They're exactly the right age. They'll both be great in the roles. Yes, I'll let you have the film rights. And so I did that. But I should have known that a verbal agreement is not worth the paper it's not written on.
And that was it. It was a verbal agreement.
Of course, yeah. Well, I didn't know they were lying to me.
How did you feel about the actors who finally played?
Well, I went to see the film, and I thought that both Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton did wonderful acting jobs. I was confused a little bit because Martha is meant to be 52 and Elizabeth was 32, and she's meant to be 6 years older than her husband George, and she was 20 years younger than her husband. I thought there were a couple of little weird things going on there. But Mike Nichols did not do anything terrible to my text. He directed what I had written and directed it beautifully. And I thought it was a pretty good movie.
Me too. Me too. All right. To Richard in Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes. This is fascinating. And I wanted to call and indicate that in 1971, when I graduated from Brown University, I was a theater arts major, and we did in that year an all-male production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
And I wonder how you got away with that. I wouldn't have allowed it.
Well, you probably wouldn't have, but it was a huge...
Because, you know, I know the difference between men and women.
It was a great... production, and we kept very true to the text.
Did you guys do it with the female roles in drag?
No.
Or did you do it as two gay couples?
We did it as males.
Two gay couples?
Yes.
And I wouldn't have let you do that because those guys weren't gay.
The only script change we did was we changed... I played the part of Martha, and we used my name. So it was Richard. And
you did was change a heterosexual female into a male gay.
You wouldn't have liked that.
Well, it doesn't strike me as being the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Richard, you've heard from the source.
Thanks. I hope you had fun, though.
Yeah. Did you?
Well, it was a... we had people pack the house night after night.
No, I bet you did.
From all up and down the East Coast.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Piqua, Ohio. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Diane. Mr. Albee?
Albee, yes.
Albee?
I was 18 years old in 1986 when I first read A Delicate Balance. Mm-hmm. My father and I weren't speaking. And he decided that he would read it as well. And we talked about the play and how wonderful it was. And Mr. Albee, you helped me and my dad have something to talk about.
Well, I'm glad of that. You know, I keep saying that theater should be useful. Mm. And if it does bring people into greater contact with each other, whether it's friendly contact or not, it doesn't matter. As long as people are put into greater contact with each other, then the play has accomplished something useful, which Indeed. Is what I keep saying the arts must do.
All right. Thanks for calling, David. To Rachel in Norwich, Connecticut. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. This is thrilling to get to say happy birthday to Molly and Edward.
Thank you.
And I'm just curious if there's any contemporary playwrights or works you've seen that have excited you, and if you feel inspired or hopeful for the state of theater besides the egregious ticket prices and whatnot. And as an early birthday present to me, any advice you would give to a burgeoning writer?
Well, as a playwright, let me answer that first, and we put Molly on for that. There are many problems in American theater. The awful, awful ticket prices, the fact that so many of our regional theaters have decided, not the arena stage, but so many of the others have decided that an audience should be given what it wants rather than what it should want. But theater can accomplish so much, and there is no paucity. There's no lack of first-rate young playwrights. I just wish we had first-rate minds which were deciding which plays were going to be done.
Mm-hmm.
We have more than enough first-rate young playwrights. We have no lack there, no lack at all.
Molly.
It's the opportunities which are lacking.
Of course.
I would completely agree. We have a number of writers that I think are influential voices, whether it's Katori Hall with her new play, The Mountaintop, Marcus Gardley, Every Tongue Confess, Amy Freed, You Nero, Lisa Crone with all of her new work, Charles Randolph Wright. I mean, we have fantastic writers. Lynn Nottage, who just wrote The Brilliant Ruined.
Will Eno is a great young writer.
Will Eno is an excellent writer. I mean, we are actually in a great moment of abundance with our American writers.
Molly Smith, she's the artistic director of Arena Stage in Washington, D.C., and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The problem, as Mr. Albee has said, is the mounting of such productions. They've become so expensive. Theaters, angels not willing to take chances. How do you get around that? You go back to the geniuses of the Edward Albees.
I think it's important to do both. At Arena, we work on past, present, and future.
Good.
As far as American writers, that's our focus, production, presentation, development, and study. And in the development and study part of what we do at Arena, we've brought on five writers that each have a 3-year contract with Arena Stage with a full salary for that 3-year period of time where they are able to write whatever they want to write.
That's wonderful.
Whether it's for us or for other theater companies, and we will ensure that we'll produce at least one of their plays.
There's one other thing that has to be done. We have to go back to educating school children in the arts.
Of course.
We've given up that. And unless you are inventing a responsible and an eager and willing young audience for the serious part of the arts by education, there's no point in doing anything.
There's another piece to that, too, which I think goes back to what Edward was saying earlier about what's our world going to be if people are only really educated in finance. The truth is, America is an imaginative world. If we are teaching people to open their imaginations. And the imaginative power of who we are as American people only can come through the arts. And so to see the consistent slashing of arts programming at the level of schools, we're cutting off ideas.
And carrying on with that, to see the constant education toward making money as opposed to developing imagination, is the discouraging aspect of where we seem headed.
It's especially discouraging when you live in a democracy where anything good is possible, if only we have the courage to deal with it.
And people do you see theater going, increasing or decreasing, Molly?
I actually see theater increasing right now. When the not-for-profit theater movement started, and Arena was one of the pioneers of that 60 years ago, there were very few theaters that were not-for-profits. Now there's 1,900 around the country.
That's wonderful.
Some are tiny and some are large, but what I am seeing is if we don't move into the kind of imagination that we're talking about, then we're in trouble as a society.
Molly Smith, she's the artistic director of Arena Stage in Washington. It's been my privilege to talk to you and to you, Edward Albee, fantastic playwright, and now here in Washington because of this wonderful festival at the Arena Stage. Thank you for being here this
And thank
morning.
You.
Thank
my
you,
pleasure.
Diane.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rain.